This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. You might have heard concerns about how the livestock industry is contributing to climate change. Well, companies around the world have been working to create lab-grown meat to help reduce the environmental footprint of meat production. You can't buy these lab-grown products in the U.S. quite yet, but Florida and Alabama already have moved to ban its sale. But do consumers even want it? Today, we're going to discuss the science, politics, sustainability, and ethics behind cellular agriculture. Joining me now are Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Meat Science and Muscle Biology, Ben Boyer. Welcome, Ben.
Good to be here.
And Tufts University Professor of Biomedical Engineering, David Kaplan. Thanks for being here, David.
Hey, good morning, all. Thanks for having me on.
The Ohio State University is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. David, thanks to the wonders of modern science, you can now grow meat from animal cells in a lab. Tell us briefly how that works.
Right. Briefly, we take a biopsy, usually from the animal, from the muscle or the fat portion, and bring that back to the laboratory where the appropriate cells, usually stem cells, are isolated. And from there, we have to propagate the cells into large amounts, usually in concert with appropriate growth media in bioreactors, and those eventually then get blended or combined with scaffolding that usually comes from plants into a structure and a function that is similar to meats and other consumables that the population's used to.
Fascinating. I've heard the bioreactors compared almost to tanks where like beer is made and that kind of thing. Is that sort of what they look like?
Great analogy to give people a picture of this, right? Large, usually stainless steel tanks.
And is that what is now being called cellular agriculture, that whole process that you've talked about?
Right. Think of it as essentially a biotechnology approach to making structured materials like muscle and fat that would go into foods, simply doing it outside of the animal instead of using the animal for the process.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned two states, Florida and Alabama, have passed these laws to keep lab-grown meat production and sales out of their states. David, you're obviously involved in this. Why do you think cellular agriculture is facing a backlash?
I can't speak for the states. I can tell you based on the science that the process is very sort of compatible with human needs, animal needs, environmental needs. I think oftentimes I'll call it fear of the unknown, maybe other issues involved, which, you know, are for the public to decide. But I think the perception in some way that foods produced outside of the animal would not be safe is, I don't want to say irrational, but there's no basis in science for that. People already consume foods made by cells throughout their lives, whether it's baked bread or fermented beer and wine and so on. So this is not really new. It's just a new sort of output from the process and new cells being used, but otherwise very similar to what people are already used to.
Hmm. Ben, you're an assistant professor of meat science and muscle biology at Ohio State. I imagine you've been following some of this. Do you think other states could follow suit with this, you know, fear, this concern, whatever it is that caused Florida and Alabama to pass these laws?
Well, I don't want to speculate too much, but it is an interesting predicament that we're in when legislators are, stepping in and maybe listening to some consumer groups in terms of fear of the product. But as David mentioned, the science and the research would certainly support that cultured meat or, cultivated meat or whatever terminology that we would want to use is a safe product. Particularly when that research begins to be analyzed by the Food and Drug Administration, I'm almost certain that they will find that these products are safe for consumption. And then in terms of advantages and disadvantages of these products compared to traditional muscle foods, we could have a conversation there, but most of that conversation will be simply on resource usage and those type of things. And then also quality of the products, the eating experience of the products, And those are not really related to safety of the products or anything along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Ben, I know some beef lobbyists, cattle ranchers, and other meat producers have expressed concern about this new technology. Can you explain why they're worried?
Yeah, so a lot of those concerns would be similar to other concerns that those commodity groups would have with labeling of products and confusion that could be created among consumers. So I like to use the analogy of when you are shopping in the dairy section of the grocery store these days, and you are searching for milk. A consumer that may not be as well versed in what the different product offerings are, they may bring home soy milk when they in fact intended to buy dairy milk. And if we go to the dairy aisle now, you could see multiple different types of products labeled as milk type beverages or milks. And not all of those would be dairy products. We could begin to see some of these same type of concerns potentially with muscle foods. So if we would go to the meat aisle, some consumers may get confused with what products make up burgers or bratwurst or hot dogs or bacon that they would traditionally associate with meat. So then we get to the point in which what defines these different type of products and the terminology that's used. And again, that gets away from the science and more of a, I guess, marketing type of approach, which again, we could have an at-length conversation about.
Yeah. David, what do you think? Do you agree with that analogy? Just kind of the, you know, concerns that have been raised about labeling and the way products are marketed and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think Ben is spot on. I think it's really important to make sure consumers know what they're getting. But in terms of, as we said before, safety, nutrition, you know, these products, there's two already approved in the U.S., two companies for sale. And in both cases, they had to go through both the Food and Drug Administration and the Department of Agriculture for approval. So any questions about safety and nutrition are really unfounded. But in terms of how these are marketed and presented to consumers, that's going to be a critical step in the process. And there's more to come there to make sure the information is transparent and everyone knows what they're getting.
We're talking today about lab-grown meat. What do you think? Would you try lab-grown burgers or chicken nuggets? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. David, I know governments around the world are investing in the development of marketable cell-cultivated meat. Tell us about why that is.
So there's many drivers today for significant investments around the world. Probably the biggest are for countries that are dependent on imports for most of their food. And examples around the world include places like Singapore, Israel, and a few others. And their public funding has been very significant for quite a while. And that's why you see innovation and many startup companies in the space, and you see approvals for selling products to the market already. I think it's slower in less dependent countries like the US. However, looking ahead for questions of food security, food quality, imports, et cetera, we have to think about this new technology as something really, really important because it gives us sort of more control of our food production systems, which I think is valuable to all of us. And this is really coming as an alternative. It's not replacing anything. It's really saying, here's a new way to make products that consumers or some consumers may want. And if so, these would be very good for you, nutritious, and hopefully cost competitive as scaling gets underway.
I wanted to ask you about cost because at this point, these methods are pretty expensive, right? How expensive is it to develop these products at this point? And, you know, do you have a sense for how they would compare now to, you know, traditionally produced meat, muscle meat that's available at the grocery store or butcher shop?
Right. I think it's too early to know what the kind of actual costs will be. And a lot of that information is not publicly available. It's held by companies, but you can look at the trajectory. And I think that's a good way to do it. It, you know, 10 years ago was the beginning of this field, and the hamburger that was shown by Cultivated Meat on UK television cost about $300,000 for a quarter pounder, right? Today, in our own lab and other labs, you can do the same thing for probably less than $30 a pound, roughly. I don't want to be specific about it. My point is, in 10 years, we've gone orders of magnitude reduced costs because of innovation and continued innovation. And I think over the next few years, with further innovation and with scale up, you'll see the costs become relatively competitive with what the consumer buys in the market today.
We do have a caller on the line. Hi, David. Thanks so much for your call. What's your question?
I'm wondering how capital and energy intensive the production and the ingredients are compared to, say, the production of meat in fields.
Okay. Thank you, David. David, our guest from Tufts University. I don't want to confuse the Davids for our listeners. What, how would you characterize the capital and energy that's used in this lab grown meat?
Right. I think in general the field suggests that the process will be less capital intensive and less demanding of resources, whether it's energy, water, land, et cetera. However, the caveat I give to that is there are no actual published examples using scaled cultivated meat to provide the basis for that. Those evaluations are starting to come, so you'll see a lot more in the future. But on just a general scientific basis, the argument is that you'll do a lot better than otherwise. So stay tuned on that. The data is coming.
Ben, is there anything you wanted to add in response to that question?
No, I agree with what David has indicated here. You know, if you think about comparing you know, muscle growth and development in a living animal versus in a bioreactor, you know, that living animal, if let's just use the example of a cow, you know, it is on pasture. It takes approximately 18 months from the time that steer heifer is born until it reaches its terminal endpoint. And while that muscle is growing, that animal may be moving around on a daily basis, expending energy for a variety of different needs. Whereas if we're growing muscle cells within a very controlled environment, most of the nutrients and that media that David was speaking about, that's providing nutrients to those muscle cells for growth, is doing so without very much wasted effort. So if we think about that just in terms of cellular growth and development, a lot of those resources are going to be utilized in a cultured meat setting that may be utilized for other purposes in a living animal.
Thanks so much for that question, David. We appreciate it. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. And later in the program, we'll talk with film critic T.T. Stern-Enzi about the father figures in some of his favorite film franchises. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about lab-grown meat. My guests are Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Meat Science and Muscle Biology, Ben Boyer, and Tufts University Professor of Biomedical Engineering, David Kaplan. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. David, what's the argument for having cell-cultivated meat instead of plant-based meat if you're looking for meat alternatives?
The biggest driver is really the issue of taste and flavor and also nutrition. So if you think about, you know, animal meats, et cetera, most of the flavor, taste, and nutrition comes from the cells present in the meat from the livestock, and most of the texture comes from the the remaining matrix that's there as the animal grows. So the idea is really to use the plant-based ingredients in cultivated meat as some of the texture, but really the taste and flavor comes from the cells along with nutrition. So that's why it's so important. And you can see that with the way plant-derived products have sort of risen and then sort of tapered off, because consumers can tell the difference, right? So I think starting to add cells into those plant-based materials will bring a huge sort of benefit in terms of all those factors.
Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit before the break with our caller David about how much capital and energy is used in the creation of lab-grown meat. How big an impact could it have on curbing methane emissions, for example, and some of the other strains that some large-scale agriculture farming puts on the environment?
Right. I think the projections are very substantive, right? Because one of the many drivers for this new technology is the sort of drive for sustainable practices. That's why the Department of Agriculture is supporting this field as well, because they see the need going forward for alternatives to current livestock processes, because we've got to be able to grow more food to feed the planet. We've got to do it in a more sustainable fashion and obviously keep nutrition and so on high on the list, along with the given safety requirements. So I think projections are we should be doing a lot better with this approach. And again, time will tell. Till we've really seen scaled processes, it's very difficult to project, but at least at the lab scale and sort of early development, I would say the technology bears out this benefit.
Ben, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the impact of farming on the environment and climate change. Do traditional farmers see this as a way that could help, or are there other things they're doing to try to change their footprint if they feel threatened by this idea of cell-based meat?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think with you know, just about anything, there is a sustainable way to do things from an environmental standpoint and an unsustainable way to do things from an environmental standpoint. And that's something, you know, we see just the diversity in terms of the ways and the production methods that go into raising livestock, some of which have maybe even positive influences on the environment, particularly if we think about, you know, returning nitrogen to the soil. In the cases of some beef operations, if we see a lot of operations talking about trying to get to more of a carbon neutral type of status. So livestock producers are improving the ways in which they produce livestock from an environmental standpoint. At the same time, the cultured meat industry offers a groundbreaking type of technology where we're able to produce, in theory, you know, products that are similar in terms of quality and nutrition, using a different set of resources, and by almost all estimations, a set of resources that would be less reliant on, you know, land, water, and also produce less greenhouse gas emissions. So if we think about the advantages of producing meat products and muscle foods with a variety of different ways, I think that this industry or this sector of the muscle food industry has a very, very bright future. And again, in terms of the resource usage of the cultured meat industry, that's something that, again, I think it's too early to tell until some of these companies start producing product at scale, in terms of what resources that they're going to be heavily relying on and maybe ways that they can improve their use of resources over time. So we're probably too early to tell to really make definitive comparisons, but it is something that's very intriguing.
Mm-hmm. David, how humane is lab-grown meat? I'm wondering, for the animals that are used to get these biopsies and these cells that are then cultivated and you know, grown in the lab, how are those animals treated?
So one of the benefits here is the treatment of animals is very, very humane. Once you take a single biopsy, in principle, you never need to go back to the animal again, in principle. And so the animals are fine after the process. It's just like if you go to the doctor for a biopsy for your own tissue, it's a pinprick and then it's done. So there's really no harm to the animal. And, you know, the cells are the only product from that animal that then get propagated downstream into the final cultivated meat material.
And would you need a diversity of cells for any reason? Like, would it help to have biopsies from more than one animal?
Oh, I think, again, one of the benefits of this field will be you'll see an immense diversification of sources of meat, because if all you need is a biopsy, number one, of course, you'll want muscle tissue, you'll want fat tissue, connective tissue to make suitable meat structured outcomes. But at the same time, you can start to isolate cells from non-traditional domesticated livestock species or fish species and diversify our palates by doing that, because you don't need large herds. You only need a single animal to get these biopsies from. But there's, again, a lot of science to go to learn about all that. But the early days suggest this is a very sort of reasonable direction for the future.
When you're talking about non-traditional livestock species, what's an example of that?
I would say, for example, if you have a wild, I don't know, I'm drawing this off the top of my head, like a deer running around, right? And you want to have the ability to grow cultivated deer meat. As long as you can get a biopsy from a single deer, you know, deer's not really domesticated in the U.S. for meat production, then you can grow deer meat. You could do the same thing for a particular species of fish that you happen to catch that's not usually, you know, found in the supermarket, and do the same thing. Mm. So the point is you can pick your favorite wild animal, if you will, and isolate and go from there in, you know, based on the principles the field is developing as we speak.
Okay. Ben, you know, we talked about how some lawmakers in some states have concerns about this, but scientists don't just have to win over lawmakers. They have to appeal to consumers, too. Do you think lab-grown meat has a PR problem, or are there people who are kind of creeped out by the idea?
Well, I'm certainly not a social scientist by, you know, training or really by employment at this point. But I know that there has been quite a bit of studies looking at, you know, consumer interest in the product and trying to pull consumers in terms of their willingness to accept these type of products. And it does seem like there is a significant proportion of consumers that would be interested in trying this product consuming this product, potentially even on a regular basis. What I think will be really important, though, you know, probably over the next 5 to 10 years, as these products become more, you know, widespread, is to make sure that the products are of a very high quality when they're introduced to consumers. Consumers have a tendency to remember their first interactions with specific food products. And if for whatever reason, cultured meat doesn't meet their expectations from a consumption standpoint, there could be issues down the road. But I would say, just like with any type of food product, there'll be some consumers that may turn their nose at the products and may not want to try the products just based on the simple fact that it's new and it is a very high tech type of a procedure to produce the product.
David, how soon do you think these products could be available on store shelves and in restaurants in the United States?
So in the U.S., as I mentioned earlier, there's already a couple of approved products from two companies, Upside Foods and Good Meat. So those have been sparsely available in certain restaurants, either in San Francisco or, I believe, Washington, D.C. And then recently, I think there was some availability, not in the U.S. yet, but in supermarkets to get some frozen product as well. So I think looking downstream, until we see more scaling, it's going to be sparse, maybe specialty restaurants for probably the next few years. But I think over the next 5 to 10 year timeframe, we'll start to see this as scale up and investments from the public sector grow, I think it'll accelerate availability in the marketplace. So I think it's not going to happen in the next year or two, but certainly over the next 5 to 10 years, we'll start to see product.
And Ben, has there been research on this in Ohio?
Not at my university. That doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't companies or university researchers interested in this in Ohio, but I don't think anybody that I'm aware of has been looking at this in the lab setting at my university. But there's lots of researchers throughout the country that David being one of those that have really been working on this extensively and has a breadth of knowledge and information on this.
Yeah. Well, this has been fascinating. I've been talking with Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Meat Science and Muscle Biology, Ben Boyer, and Tufts University Professor of Biomedical Engineering, David Kaplan. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Up next, we'll hear from film critic T.T. Stern Enzi about the father figures and some of his favorite film franchises. This is Cincinnati Edition.